You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Negebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Negebauer, and Happy New Year, everyone. Today we have an awesome show. We are going to have Jim Freese and David Bain on the show in studio, which is going to be awesome. And they're going to talk about our upcoming Whale Scout Helping Out event with Friends of North Creek Forest at North Creek Forest on January 31st from 10 to 2. And so it's going to be great. We're going to have them in studio to talk all about the forest, why it's important, and exactly what we're going to be doing on the 31st. But first, I thought I would talk to you a little bit about the year in review. The big stories this year were all about Southern residents and all about how there weren't very many Southern residents, especially no new babies. And then towards the end of the year, as I will talk about, we all of a sudden had two new babies born and lots of drama and confusion and people being really excited and then upset. We started the year with 80 whales. And, and we hadn't had a successful calf in like 2 years. And that was very disappointing. And then in the summer, it was announced that Lulu L53, a 37-year-old female who had never had any surviving calves, had disappeared and presumably had died, along with L100 Indigo, who was a 13-year-old male. And that brought us down to 78 whales, which was the lowest point we had been since 2005, when the Southern residents were listed as endangered. And this really set off a lot of red flags, alarm bells for a lot of people, just really concerned that we hadn't really gotten anywhere since they were listed as endangered in 2005. And there's sort of like two sides to that distress. There's this people being upset, but then this also call to action, which is the flip side and the good side of that. Throughout the year, in May and in towards the end of the year in November, we had two different salmon recovery and orca recovery workshops sponsored by the Whale Museum, Salmon, and Orca Network. And these workshops were unique in that people were really starting to get together and talk about salmon, because we know that salmon abundance is critical for the recovery of Southern resident killer whales. So to me, that was also a highlight of the year, is getting everyone together to talk about these issues and becoming, for me, and I know for a lot of other whale geeks, more salmon literate. Because if we love our whales, we have to really figure out what to do for salmon. Then in early September, L86 Surprise gave birth to L120, bringing the population back up to 79. And, people were so excited, we'd gone all summer not seeing any new whales, and then finally in the fall, a new baby. It was also kind of special because L86 Surprise was also the mother of Sook, L112, who washed up on a beach with just terrible hemorrhaging and injuries back in 2012. And it was, people are still sort of speculating over some Navy or military sonar exercises or underwater explosions contributing to her death. There was a podcast that we did here with Ken Balcom in 2014, and you can go back and listen on iTunes or on the Whale Scout website for free, all about L112. Unfortunately, L120 only lived a few weeks. Scientists went back out about 7 weeks later, saw all the whales, saw L86, but they did not see the new baby L120, and it was presumed dead. You know, with the cases like this where babies go missing, there's no, or any whale goes missing, we don't have very many clues as to what may have happened that led to their death. So with L120, we don't really know, but a lot of people are speculating that there's just not enough salmon in the water to feed these whales. And if mama can't eat, mama can't feed baby. So that's sort of what is suspected. I should also note, though, that these little calves have a very, very low chance of survival. Probably less than half of all the whales, southern residents that are born, don't make it. So it's important that we just do all that we can to feed the whales and give these little guys as much of a chance as possible. Then on December 4th, a killer whale had washed ashore up in Canada at a fishing resort. And at first, you know, we didn't know if it was a resident or transient. We just knew it was a killer whale. And people were very concerned that it could be a southern resident or a northern resident. And later that day, some Canadian scientists came out and extracted the fecal material out of the whale and saw that it contained fish bones. So it was an immediate indication that this was a resident. They still didn't know southern resident or northern resident. Until later that night, a whale watching captain out of Campbell River went out, and it looked to me literally like an iPhone photo or like a GoPro that was a little bit underwater. He took this camera and took a shot of the left and right side saddle patch and dorsal fin and put them on Facebook. And this was like late at night. So the role of social media also in 2014 cannot be understated, because the whale was identified by naturalists and people on Facebook before, you know, Stephen Raverty and other scientists had even a chance to get out there and do the work. So it was sort of interesting how it worked, because the person posted the photos and then they were pulled right away, and then put back up later. But we knew from those photos that it was J-32 Rhapsody, and it was extremely disappointing. It was a young whale, in the middle of her reproductive, time. And over the summer, many, many people had suspected that she was pregnant, because she would breach all the time and people could see that her belly was looking quite round. And, you know, the rumors were so intense that people would go online and they would make these silly little tabloid covers with Rhapsody on the front. Is she pregnant? Is she not? Is it a baby bump? Is it not? And I even asked Jessica Lundin on the podcast just weeks before she had turned up dead on the beach in Canada if she was pregnant, just to put these rumors to rest. And you can listen to that podcast also on iTunes or whalescout.org. And Jessica Lundin said that they had not gotten a sample from her that summer, so the rumors continued. But then when we found her on the beach, she was pregnant with a full-term calf. And as it stands right now, you know, it may take weeks before we really understand exactly what happened, but the Stephen Raverty has determined, among other scientists in Canada, that there was an infection resulting from the death of the full-term calf within her belly and her inability to expel that calf. And that infection ultimately led to her death. Now, why that full-term calf died before being born, you know, we still don't know, and we may never know. But over time, more and more clues and tests will be done. And so it's really important that we keep this energy and interest in the story going forward, so that the public will be aware of what happened. And of course, we will be following up with all of those updates. And, you know, as disappointing as it was when J-32 Rhapsody died, you know, it was an amazing opportunity to study killer whales and calves, because we don't know why it's been now 2.5 years where no new calves have been born and survived. So it's an opportunity to understand, you know, what was mama eating? Was she eating enough? What was her toxin load? What was the baby's physical condition? Did it develop normally or did it not? What were the baby's toxin loads? So it's an amazing opportunity to sort of get some clues, because there's probably a few calves born every year that we don't even know existed, because they're out. You know, we haven't seen L-pod or K-pod in a little while, and they could have easily had a calf born and then died, and we would have never known about it. So it's a good opportunity that we're seeing this whale, and for the scientific reasons, having the opportunity to study her and the calf, so that we can try to make a difference for those other calves out there that we may not be seeing, and whose stories that we may not be even able to tell. And following the death of J32, people kept asking, you know, what can I do to help? You know, people on Facebook made new pages dedicated to Rhapsody and taking action. And, you know, the Whale Trail hosted an event, you know, Finding Light in the Darkness, I think is what it was called. And in Whale Scout, we were there, and there's a lot of other groups there doing really good things for the whales and give people the opportunity to get involved. We set out an RSVP list for our January 31st Helping Out event, and we had quite a few people RSVP and say that they are going to come, which is great. And there's no better way than really physically getting out, getting your hands dirty, and physically making the habitat for Chinook salmon better. We know that that's the key to recovering Chinook salmon, and then we know that the key to recovering southern resident killer whales is to recover Chinook. So, you know, right after J32's death, by the way, we had a Helping Out event out by the Cedar River, and we had to decide, you know, like, gosh, well, the event is scheduled. We're moving forward, but people were still just reeling and upset by her death. And there were a number of people who came that day and just said it was really healing to be able to get out and to do something physical. Other things that people have done after her death is there's a petition on change.org called the Southern Resident Chinook Salmon Initiative, and that's gained a lot of traction, and we're aimed at convincing politicians to remove the four lower Snake River dams. And this is a huge, huge controversial project that's been going on for a number of years, but getting whale people behind it, in addition to salmon people, may be just enough to tip the balance. From what I understand is that there's a lot of farming interests in the U.S. or the Washington side that are preventing the dams from being removed. So go up there and check that out on Facebook and at change.org. And, you know, we're going to keep moving forward with all of our restoration events. In 2015, we're going to up all of our events from about four times a year, which is what we've been doing so far in just the first 6 months that we've been really moving forward with our programs, up to about one every month. And we're going to expand all the way up into other areas throughout the Southern Resident Killer Whale Range in Puget Sound. So stay tuned for that. And then, of course, the birth of J50, which was just very, very recently, right towards the end of the year, I believe on December 30th, whale watchers and the Center for Whale Research discovered a new baby swimming with J16, Slick, a 42-year-old female who already has three surviving calves. And, you know, it's so funny because just being on Facebook is just so interesting because people are out seeing the whale, and within minutes they're phoning back to the office, you know, in Victoria, and they're posting updates on Facebook saying that there's a new calf. And it's before the boats are even off the water, before any photos have been downloaded, we're already hearing about it. So within a couple hours, we've got people going back, putting up the first baby photos and videos of J50. And then just the next day, you know, Ken Balcom from the Center for Whale Research began stringing together some more information. You know, J16 is 42 years old, and it's not unheard of that she could have a new calf. But J36, Alki, who's J16 Slick's daughter, would probably be more likely that she would be having a calf. And that day, J36 Alki wasn't counted by the center. And so then rumors began flying all over Facebook. Well, what about J36? Did she die? Did she die during childbirth too? And luckily, Melissa Pinnow, who's an ID whiz, by the way, was out on the water that day and did have a few photos of J36 Alki. And so scientists aren't sure, you know, who's the mom of J50? Is it J16 Slick or is it J36 Alki? And then more photos popped up where the new baby had rake marks from an adult killer whale on its dorsal fin, quite significant. And so they started to speculate, you know, was this an assisted birth where could have been difficult and that another whale had to pull J-50 out of the womb. So maybe it was J-36 Alki, and she was just recovering and resting a little bit further away from the rest of the group. And Grandma, J-16 Slick, was just babysitting. So we don't really know yet who's the mom, but we're hoping that whoever the mom is healthy. Personally, I'm leaning towards J-16 Slick, even though she's an older whale, but she's an experienced mother. She likely has a much lower toxin load than J-36 Alki, who has not ever had a surviving calf, at least that we're aware of. She may even be a first-time mother, I'm not really sure, but it's likely that since she hasn't nursed and offloaded a lot of those toxins, that she would be much more toxic than her mom, and then that milk would be much more toxic. And we know that oftentimes first calves don't make it, and so the more calves a mama has, the more likely they are to survive. So, but we'll know more as people go out and watch the J-Pod. There's another interesting thing that happened that may give us some clues to sort of help us track down J-Pod. Just literally days before we found J-50, J-27 BlackBerry was satellite tagged by NOAA scientists. And there, NOAA scientists know in real time where J-27 BlackBerry is at all times. And so if they wanted to, they could go out and track J-Pod, and presumably the rest of the pod mates would be there. Not all the time, because we do know that they splinter off into smaller groups. But they could easily track the rest of the pod and try to keep up with the new baby and see how it was doing. But that's yet to be done. We know that BlackBerry has been up in the Strait of Georgia in BC, which is following a very similar track as L87, who travels with J-Pod, was a whale that they tagged last year. You know, they're getting a lot of really similar data from last year. In my personal opinion, I think it would have been a little bit more insightful to get data off of an L-pod whale or even a K-pod whale that is out on the outer coast. There's a petition out right now from the Center for Biological Diversity trying to expand critical habitat out there. You know, it's good data to have that they're in the inland waters of the Salish Sea, but we kind of already knew that. This could lead scientists to monitor J-50 a little bit closer. What they could do from just monitoring, I don't really know, but it would at least give us some information. And I wanted to give a little bit of an update of what Whale Scout has been doing the last 6 months, really since our programs have been up and running since about May or June of this year. We've had 3 Help and Out events, which brought in 70 people, 290 hours, and we've planted 300 trees, spread 35 cubic yards of mulch, and removed invasive species from about 15 cubic yards. So it's been absolutely wonderful doing these events. And probably the highlight of the year was in October, and seeing a bunch of sockeye salmon swimming up North Creek after we had just been out removing invasive species and planting trees and watering. And you know, the forest acts like a big sponge to remove any toxins that would enter North Creek. And so keeping those salmon healthy is critically important. And we do know that Chinook salmon also use that creek. We launched our Puget Sound whale watching program with naturalists in the fall. And so far, we have about 15 volunteers actually out on the beaches who've contributed about 70 hours whale watching and have had 250 face-to-face interactions with people on the beach watching whales. And there's no better time to really inspire people to take action for killer whales when you're seeing them in the wild from shore, right in your own backyard. So this has been a big accomplishment, and we're going to expand up into the San Juan Islands this year, which is going to be really exciting, and more information on that later. Towards the end of the year, we were also awarded our 501c3 federal nonprofit status, which means that all of your donations are tax deductible. So get out and push that donate button on whalescout.org. And another project or a project that we're working towards in the future are adding a social media campaign aimed at individual everyday stewardship actions to support the recovery of Southern residents. And, you know, we're going to be rolling out educational materials and all sorts of fun stuff in the coming year. And so I would invite you to visit whalescout.org or like us on Facebook, follow what we're doing. It's going to be an amazing year in 2015. We're thinking big, dreaming big, putting feet on the ground, moving forward. And it's going to be bigger and better than last year, and we're really excited about it. And so now I would like to invite David Bain and Jim Fries on the show to talk about our next Helping Out event. Welcome back to the podcast. I am joined now by Jim Fries, who is Friends of North Creek Forest Executive Director, and David Bain, who is the Friends of North Creek Forest Vice President and Killer Whale Biologist. Thank you so much, guys, for coming into the studio today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And so I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about the forest. And Whale Scout has come out to the forest a number of times. In fact, we were out in October, did a lot of restoration work in the forest, and then went down to North Creek and saw salmon in North Creek, which was probably the highlight of all of our Helping Out events all year. So we are really excited to be back on January 31st. Can you tell us a little bit about your group and about the forest?
Well, our group started as an outgrowth of another group that started maybe 14 years ago. They resisted development for quite a while and worked with the city to get a grant from King County. And that was about to expire, and there just weren't any matching funds anywhere. And in a sort of anxious moment, we decided to go on in some directions they weren't really interested in going. And so we formed another organization and sort of went out in what we call a comprehensive campaign. And it began with trying to identify who our natural allies were. And it became very obvious to us that there were 9,000 students within walking distance back then. That's up to 13,000 now. It's just north of the University of Washington, Bothell Campus, Cascadia Community College. It's got all kinds of public and private schools all around it. So it's a perfect setting for education. The goal is to create a 64-acre outdoor education laboratory.
And this forest is located right in the heart of Bothell, which is where I lived and grown up. Why is it so important to the residents of Bothell and for local wildlife?
Well, I'll let our whale biologist handle the wildlife part. I'll just say to the residents of Bothell, we're a very fast-growing community. This is definitely an urban forest. It's sandwiched between a high-tech jobs corridor and residential development. And as I say, there's so many students within walking distance. This is an opportunity for students to see nature without having to get in a car and drive for an hour out into the foothills of the Cascades. We've had multiple classes visit the forest. Whale Scouts has been out several times. And it's consistent. People, they enjoy the educational experience. They enjoy having a chance to help out with the stewardship. And I should add, we're almost there. We've got 42 acres saved and half the money raised for the last 22 acres.
Okay, and on the wildlife side, one of the things we think is really important is connectivity. And North Creek Forest is actually important both to terrestrial animals and aquatic life like salmon. So we looked at what would happen if the hillside were developed and you changed the runoff into North Creek. And we realized there'd be a lot of sedimentation in North Creek that would have affected the salmon spawning there. But also that sediment would have gone down to the Sammamish River and potentially blocked salmon migration, farther upstream. So there were several other major creeks like Little Bear Creek and Bear Creek, and then even the Issaquah's salmon hatchery might have been affected because it's upstream of where North Creek would have damaged the Sammamish River. So from a killer whale perspective, seeing that much more salmon loss was really scary because we don't have enough salmon as it is, and losing more would just make things that much worse. And on the terrestrial side, despite all the urban development, you'd still be a deer and walk from Lake Washington up to the Cascades. But North Creek Forest is part of the last route to get there. So if it had been developed and made impassable to wildlife, then we'd basically isolate the urban wildlife around Seattle from the rural wildlife up in the Cascade foothills and Cascades.
And so which species of salmon does the forest help protect? And then how does it protect these salmon?
Okay. As a killer whale biologist, it's the Chinook salmon that I'm worried about protecting. But North Creek actually has a lot more sockeye salmon than any other type. We also see a few chum salmon in there and quite a few coho. And what salmon need is cool, clean water. And what forests do is filter water. So when rain lands on the tops of trees, it can take hours for it to get from the top of a tree to a bottom. So instead of having a flash flood event, that water gradually trickles down and make sure that you don't have so much water going into the creek at once that it washes all the salmon eggs away. We also have a problem with copper and oil. The copper is released from brake pads every time somebody steps on the brakes, and that can kill coho salmon in a matter of hours, and it causes neurological damage to other species. And the forest can serve to trap that copper and oil from the neighborhoods up above North Creek before it gets down into the water. So that should increase survival. Another thing a forest does is it lets water soak into the ground, and then that water will flow underground down to the creek. And that process can take several months, and the water will stay cool because it's down underground. It's not heating up in the sunshine. So in the middle of our dry season, when it's really warm, you'll have this trickle of cool water that fell the winter before, finally making it into the creek. So that keeps the water level up and it keeps the water cool, and that helps the fish survive.
Right, and so if we would have had cement or pavement over that, there would have been no way for that water to sort of build in that reservoir underground.
Yeah. In the built environment, what people try to do is get water out to Puget Sound as quickly as possible. So you see your little storm drain, and then it goes into pipes, and those pipes head out to Puget Sound. And the idea is to get the water out there before it can flood the neighborhood.
And sometimes people ask me, like, why Bothell? Why do you start in Bothell to help protect killer whales? Can you sort of connect the path of a salmon from the forest all the way to a killer whale?
Okay. Well, as we all know, salmon spawn in creeks and rivers. So a Chinook salmon will lay its eggs in North Creek, and then that salmon will hatch, and it'll start swimming downstream. And if the forest had been developed, then as it tries to get downstream, it would probably get killed by sediment. But with the water clean enough, it can go down to the Sammamish River and into Lake Washington, and then it can sneak through Ballard Locks and get out to Puget Sound. And then once it's out in the Sound, it has a chance to develop, and Chinook salmon might spend a year in Puget Sound getting a little size on them, and then they'll migrate out to sea. And they'll feed out at sea for a few years to become quite large. And then they swim back towards Bothell. And when they're trying to get back in, southern resident killer whales know they're coming. So they're kind of waiting there trying to get enough to eat while they come through. And the ones that don't get eaten go back through the locks and into Lake Washington. And they swim back up the Sammamish River and North Creek and spawn to launch the next generation.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So we've drawn the connection now between the forest, the salmon, and the killer whales. There's so many different things that people can do to help killer whales, and one might ask, why plant trees and restore forests when someone could go out and build a rain garden or fight against salmon farms or do any number of things. Why is planting trees and restoring forests just just the greatest.
Well, I don't know if I'd say it's the greatest, but I think it's something the greatest number of people can participate in, because there are lots of other creeks that are just like North Creek. And, you know, when we're talking about killer whales, we say they're dying the death of a thousand cuts, because there are all these little problems here and there that just add up and become overwhelming. And if you think about it, the cure for a death of a thousand cuts is a thousand Band-Aids. And if we have thousands or hundreds of thousands of people doing little things like planting a few trees each year, then that restores the habitat, it increases salmon survival, and that gives us more food for the salmon to eat. You know, if you happen to be in a good place to put in a rain garden, that's wonderful, because rain gardens are also really good at taking these toxins out of stormwater. And if you have good political connections and you can talk people into tearing down dams, you know, we've seen wonderful things removing the Elwha dams have done, and they've barely been down a year. So there are lots of other things. And you know, if in your daily life you can ride a bike instead of drive a car, that's that much less oil getting into the water, and that much more, you know, herring survival and salmon survival. And it's really going to take all of these things. There are a lot of little things that we as individuals can do, and then there are some big things we need to rely on government to do. So, you know, some of us need to be lobbying government to do those big things, and others of us need to do the little things to keep the salmon and the whales alive until government does the big fixes.
And for those of us who are planning on attending the event on January 31st at North Creek Forest, what sort of things can we expect to be doing?
Well, we'll supply all of the tools, gloves, wear forest-appropriate clothes, footwear. We'll have a barbecue in the middle, so we'll be eating a little bit. We have the site this year. This is our fourth year of restoration activity with the University of Washington, and this year's site is covered in English ivy primarily. We're going to be removing some English ivy. We should have some mulch on site by then. We're going to need to transport some mulch, and it's going to be interesting because first we have to slide it down a steep hill and then pick it up and distribute it to the bottom. It'd be kind of hard to take wheelbarrows down that steep slope. We will probably have some trees to plant. I don't think we're going to have an area big enough to plant a lot of them, but we might get enough for kids to go out in small groups and all work on planting a tree and learn how to spread the roots properly and build a cone that the roots drape down around. All of the very best techniques for planting a tree. We'll have some classes. I'm not sure which ones. Sometimes I believe we're having water quality and tree identification, I think, might be the other one. The education committee is meeting this week to finalize that. And we might have a chance to do a brief hike, too. If the weather's permitting, we'll see how soaked people get. This is iffy time of the year.
January 31st, it never rains.
Not usually. Not in Bothell. Around Bothell, yes. That rain shadow is kind of around us. You know? I want to add also, David said something about death of a thousand cuts, and I'm reminded of something David brought up. I believe it was quoted by a judge of the Maury Island case. Which raindrop caused the flood? And I really think it's important to know that everything that each person does out there that day and each day makes a difference. It's in reverse. Instead of the raindrop causing the flood, it's which one begins to fix the problem. I love this idea of a million trees in Puget Sound. I think it's awesome. It seems like a daunting challenge right now, but I know there's a lot of people out there who want to do this. So let's see it happen. Let's start.
And I do want to remind people that if you've been out to the forest before, this is at a new location, correct?
Yes, it is. I'll give you the address right now. It's on the corner of 108th Avenue Northeast and Northeast 204th in Bothell, and the zip code is 98011. So that's 204th, 108th Avenue Northeast and Northeast 204th.
And all the information is up at whalescout.org, so you can go up there. We also have a Facebook event page where you can RSVP. Otherwise, send me an email at info@whalescout.org. This event is great for kids. We always have tons of people come out, families, Cub Scouts, Girl Scouts. It's a lot of fun. So please RSVP so that we have enough food to go around for everyone. And if someone can't come to the event on the 31st, what can they do to get in touch with you and contribute to the work that you're doing?
Easiest way is simply go to our website or Facebook page. Easiest way, there's a contact form on our website, friendsnorthcreekforest.org. And all of the work party schedules are there, too. So if you really can't make this one, I have to say, though, this is one of the most fun ones we do in the year. It's fantastic. But if you can't make it, there are other events. I think we're going to be joined by another organization out there that day, too. It's Evergreen Karate and Jiu-Jitsu on Main Street in Bothell. Should be out with families and some fine-tuned workers that day. And I think the neighbors had a cookie exchange last week, and they all signed up. They expect to bring their kids down, too. So we're going to have a mob.
That's great. Yeah, the kids at Evergreen Karate and Jiu-Jitsu love going out to these events. And we've got little kids, you know, anywhere from 4 to, you know, 12 are the ones that I teach. And they're always looking forward to going out and watering the plants and running around in the trees. So thank you so much for working hard to save this forest for all of, you know, the Bothell families in this area. Is there anything else you two wanted to add?
Well, I just want to say how important it is to reverse what I see as a decline in ecological literacy. And this is a perfect place to do it. We've had children come out to that forest that have never been in a forest in their entire life, fifth graders. We have college students doing research in the forest. David was the academic advisor for a year-long amphibian study. And I'll never forget the day that one of the students called and said, "You got to get down here fast. There's salamanders everywhere." We found over 100 salamanders in an hour. Hmm. I mean, the biodiversity and the terrestrial diversity in the forest is just amazing once kids get a chance to be exposed to it. It's just a joy to be able to work on it.
And I guess another thing you can do is go to Facebook and look for the Million Tree Challenge. And basically what we're trying to do there is get people who care about whales working together with people who restore forest land so that we really can get massive numbers of people involved. And, you know, for one person to plant a million trees is impossible, but, you know, if we get 100,000 or 200,000, then you're looking at one or two weekends a year, and all of a sudden it looks a lot more feasible. So we need to remember we've got power in numbers, and if a lot of us are willing to work together, then we don't have to work too hard to make some big changes.
Right, and you're talking about this Million Tree Challenge, not just in Bothell or Puget Sound, but throughout the southern resident killer whale range, Canada to California and anywhere you might live.
That's right. And even if you're in Ireland, you know, it would be good for you to participate. You know, obviously a tree in Ireland is not going to clean up water in Pacific Northwest streams, but there are two other major challenges that killer whales face. One is climate change, because salmon do not do well in warm conditions. So, you know, if we can keep the atmosphere cool, that'll help keep the water cool and help them survive. But even on the track we're on right now, we're looking at losing at least 40% of our salmon population to warming. And the other big threat is from ocean acidification that's killing a lot of shelled mollusks when they're at their larval stage down toward the bottom of the food chain. So that's another thing where trees taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere is going to be really important to mitigating that problem. So that's one advantage of forests over rain gardens is, you know, the forests will sequester CO2, and rain gardens are good at sequestering toxic chemicals, but they generally don't have the biomass to sequester CO2.
So you can join in on this Million Tree Challenge on Facebook. Come out to our event on the 31st and get going on your trees for the year. I want to thank David Bain and Jim Fries for coming on the show today. Thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing you on the 31st.
Thanks, thank Whitney. You. See you for about 10 o'clock that day.
Thank you.
Hamburgers are at noon.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.